in your face. I'm thrilled to have Ian Seal in the studio from Many Coloured Sky, the queer development agency. Ian, welcome to 3CR.
Thanks. Hi, James.
It is so great to see you after all these years. Many Coloured Sky is such a vital organisation. Describe it in your own words.
Sure, thank you. Look, we're 14 years old as a small Australian charity, and we do call ourselves the Queer Development Agency because of our work predominantly in the Asia Pacific and in Africa. We're partnering with queer community organisations on the ground and helping them to meet their own goals. So we help to kind of resource those goals. But I guess we're better known here in Melbourne now for our large program supporting queer refugees and people seeking asylum. And we've supported around 700 people since we began doing that work in 2018.
Wow, that is a massive brief, not just working with people with complex issues in countries where perhaps homosexuality is criminalised, but also people who have come from those countries and are here.
Yeah, look, we're spread pretty thin. We're only a small team, and we don't have a solid core of organisational funding to drive the work. But I'm very proud of the work that we've been able to do, and I think the heavy lifting that the community does here, the queer refugee community does here, is what enables us to spread our resources as best we can.
So, what are some of the projects you're working on at the moment?
So I guess what really drives our work here in Melbourne is two things for queer refugees and asylum seekers. One is about social connection. So we run a huge fortnightly dinner where members come together and cook. And there could be anything from 50 or 60 people coming along to each of those fortnightly dinners. We run a range of kind of workshops and other activities and nature-based programs and all sorts of things to give people a sense of, an opportunity to come and connect and make friends. But then we also do a lot of casework. So this is a group of people who their rights are not routinely recognised in a range of different settings because of visa challenges and those sorts of things. They may not have employment or any kind of solid form of employment. So a lot of our work is helping to navigate to resources around housing, around mental health, around material support, and just really being a place that people can expect to be listened to and respected when they're sharing their challenges.
I mean, that work is vital because it breaks down people's social isolation. There may be language barriers, for example, cultural barriers, but just a disconnection from the LGBTIQ community, and you build that bridge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've got people from 56 different countries. So yeah, many, many different languages spoken when we have our dinners and our community events. But yeah, you're right. There's a disconnection from queer community. There are people often don't have the opportunities or feel safe enough to go and throw themselves in at the deep end of our fabulous community. And many have experienced some really dreadful things too that make it challenging for them to be themselves in a public space. And at the same time, a lot of them have lost any sense of connection or opportunity to connect to people of their own cultural background because of homophobic and transphobic prejudice. And so we do find that social isolation is a huge challenge for people.
Your work must be pretty challenging at the moment in terms of the times that we're living in, underscoring the need for your organisation, Many Coloured Sky, with the rise of One Nation, anti-immigrant sentiments, etc.
Look, it is. It's a very, very tough time. It's tougher to find funding to support the work. We're seeing many, many more people who are hearing about or experiencing prejudice on the streets and in community. Our international programs have had a real setback in since Trump became President. Trump 2.0. It's very difficult to resource those things, and people are really falling through the cracks everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you would do work in countries where USAID has been just pulled out in environments where it was so needed.
That's right, and in many countries that we work, of course, queer organisations can't exist legally, but groups of people come together to look after themselves and each other. And where they have been able to get some funding, it's predominantly been through HIV/AIDS funding. And I guess that's a history we know well here in Australia as well, that queer organisations have often grown from HIV/AIDS organisations. Now those organisations have been completely defunded across many parts of the world.
So name some of the countries that you work in. I mean, I was looking at places like, you know, Indonesia, for example.
Yeah, we do a lot of work in Indonesia and in Southeast Asia more broadly. Those are programs that, two strands really. So one is about just capacity building for those organizations. So what technical support can we provide? Can we help fund organizations in a small way because we're not a big organization? Can we help them to connect them to other advocates, other human rights experts and the like so that they can grow their profile? But we also do work that began in the Philippines and then has been replicated in Indonesia and India, focusing specifically on queer children and young people. And that's work that provides direct support to young people, but also where we can, works in schools, with parents and families, and with community organisations.
You do amazing work with very little funding. Tell us about your funding arrangements.
So, look, the international work has never had a dollar of government funding. We've relied 100% on the kindness of donors, and generally it's individual donors. We've had a couple of philanthropic grants at different times that have enabled us to do project work, so really scale up our capacity, do some really exciting work, and then unfortunately that's not, you know, those kind of grants are not ongoing. So we have to work all the time in ways that make sure that we're building rather than creating dependence on who we are and how we work. But yeah, look, it's phenomenal how I think we're telling some really important stories, and particularly the queer community here in Melbourne know that this isn't work that's being supported in any other ways. And so people do their best to, you know, a large number of people can provide very small donations to us, and that can really help us to do some phenomenal work.
So you're a genuine community development agency where you resource communities to be self-sufficient so that they're connected and can function without necessarily you guys being around.
That's right. That's right. And you know, we don't go into anyone else's country or home and assume that we know what people want and need and what is best for anyone else. Our first task really is just to listen and learn and to see, can we be useful? Yeah, is there something that we can offer this community that they don't have access to themselves? And yeah, I guess we're often working in places where a small amount of money can go a long way. So a lot of the grants that we provide to partner organisations are in the hundreds of dollars rather than the thousands of dollars. But for communities that have nothing, that makes a real difference.
I'm fascinated by the work that you do here in Melbourne, you know, around food and culture. I mean, you can't put a value on that.
No, I agree. And I think one of the joys every single fortnight when we have our dinner is just seeing people who have not had the opportunity to be themselves in a public space ever before. We'll have one or two new people every single fortnight who've never been to a queer community organisation before, and so they're walking into something that's a little bit terrifying when you first arrive, but they'll be greeted at the door by someone who's expecting them, who knows who they are and who makes them feel welcome and introduces them around. And it's a real pleasure just to see the joy that people experience and the sense of family that they create by coming together in a place where they really can be themselves.
So I'm fascinated by the breakdown of the people who are involved in your organisation. You know, I imagine there's international students. I imagine there's people who are very much a part of the gig economy here in Melbourne. I imagine there's refugees and asylum seekers. Like, yeah, what's the kind of breakdown of the roles, the backgrounds?
Yeah, look, it's a very, very diverse community, and so there are people who have arrived here on a permanent humanitarian visa, so they've been recognised and assessed as a refugee before arriving in the country. And we are now Australia's first and only queer-specific settlement service provider. So we get some funding from the Department of Home Affairs to support that community. But they are about a third of our total cohort. So essentially for two-thirds of the group that we work with, we don't get any funding. And those people are predominantly on some sort of bridging visa. So they've arrived here and they've sought protection and they're still undergoing the process of assessment. During that period, they don't have the opportunity. Many of them don't have the opportunity to work. They can't claim Centrelink. There's a whole range of challenges and barriers that get in the way. We have some people who are international students, but who have found themselves really lost and lonely and alone. And also, you know, students who've they've transitioned since they've arrived in the country, or they've found themselves in a way that means that they no longer feel safe to go home. And so they're also on the journey of seeking protection.
So you're dealing with a lot of trauma.
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, I think that that goes with the experience of almost everyone who walks into the room. And yeah, alongside trauma, I guess grief and loss as well. You know, it can feel very liberating to make an active choice to step into a new space, but you're always stepping away from family and friends and loved ones in order to do that.
You must do a lot of work linking folks into other LGBTIQ organisations here in Melbourne. And one of the things that jumped out to me was presumably people with HIV who need treatments that aren't necessarily eligible for Medicare.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And, you know, it's great that there are options for treatment available to people who are not on Medicare specifically related to HIV, but there's a limit to services that are provided. We have great relationships with the various HIV organisations that work here in Melbourne, and they've been very supportive of this community. But a lot of people are coming from a background where they have not had that form of support before and don't necessarily know that that's available to them. One of the things that we're doing is kind of sharing what is available in Melbourne that they may not have been able to access anywhere else.
Wow, you must have an incredible roadmap in your head of LGBTIQ services here in Victoria.
Look, we've done some really solid work over the years to build relationships, and I think I want to say really clearly, we've never had an organisation who hasn't risen to the occasion, who hasn't wanted to support this community. That doesn't mean that there aren't always, unfortunately, pragmatic barriers in the way. The funding that some of those organisations receive will preclude some people on temporary visas. But yeah, look, generally we've had really positive support. And we're doing more and more work, really, to build bridges so that we can develop programs together. I think We learn from those organisations who have kind of specialist programs that they can run for community, and at the same time they learn from us and from our community about how they can respond to such a diverse, culturally diverse group of people.
You must be working with a lot of people overseas who are really in danger, activists who are sticking their neck out to support community and work with you guys.
Yeah, look, we've got people who are absolutely in dangerous situations. We've got people who are hungry every day of the week. And I think one of the real challenges we've seen in the last couple of years since USAID pulled out and sadly other organisations followed is that we were previously supporting a small organisation who could do work for 200, 300, 500 people in their community because they had a solid base of operations for themselves. And now it's actually the people who were the staff of those organisations, the people who were the strength for everyone else in the community who are themselves also in need and also going hungry. So it's a really, really tough time.
With USAID being cut like so brutally, I imagine it's a concern who's moving into the space, who's filling the vacuum, because they're not necessarily LGBTIQ friendly organisations, are they?
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I think we all know that when the US kind of pulled out of this sort of work, they also lost the soft power, the influence that the US has had previously to actually temper some of the worst homophobia in governments in other places. And essentially what's happened in the last couple of years is governments like the government of Uganda have felt emboldened actually to increase their homophobic prejudice and the way that they very badly persecute queer people in Uganda. So that's a real challenge. And I wish I could say someone had wholeheartedly stepped into that space, but really there is no one of the size and scale of US international funding as it was a couple of years ago. And with the pressure in Europe of European countries to focus on their own defence, they're also scaling back their international development budgets. And there were countries like the Netherlands who were very supportive of queer organisations. They still are on paper, but they're putting far less money into that work now than they were previously.
And I imagine there's some religious US missionary organisations filling the space.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, look, yeah, they've been around for a long time. And again, to speak about Uganda, they've had an outsize and very negative influence for, you know, at least a decade now on queer politics in Uganda. I wish I could say that there were, that there were some positives in where we are at the moment. If there is one, it's that mainstream international development organisations, so Save the Children, Oxfam, UNICEF, all of those, have taken a stronger position around inclusion than they had done previously. So at least we're seeing more advocacy happening in the space.
Is Australia doing enough to take in queer folks who are trying to get out of these countries?
Look, Australia's doing some great things, but enough? No. We could always do more. I think it's really exciting that there is now some clear work being done in the department to ensure that you know, queer people's persecution is being recognised, and queer people do have a pathway to come here. But the pressures on immigration more broadly mean that numbers are, you know, likely to be scaled back. So, you know, in future we may see less refugees coming into the country. That's a real concern. And if we do, of course, that will mean less queer people too.
It sounds like the scope of the work of Many Coloured Sky has really expanded in recent years.
Yeah, look, it has. I think if it wasn't for COVID, we would probably look very different. That COVID briefly stopped any opportunity, obviously, to leave the country and do direct work out of Australia. But it really accelerated the need for community here. I guess a huge learning for me in COVID was that newly arrived people, when they come to Australia, can generally rely on people of their own cultural background when times are tough. And of course, times were very, very tough during COVID. And what we saw is that queer people don't feel that they can rely on people of their own cultural background in the same way. So we had to respond to that. And, you know, at the beginning of the first COVID lockdown, we were supporting 28 people. By the end of the COVID lockdowns, we were supporting close to 200 people. And it's only accelerated now that we're supporting more than 700.
Wow. So COVID saw your domestic work just skyrocket. There must be lots of people who haven't recovered since COVID, right?
Yeah, look, very, very much so. And, you know, the part of the challenge, particularly for people who may be asylum seekers, is that they can be left in limbo for very, very long periods of time. They don't have any certainty over whether ultimately their claim will be recognised and they'll be given permanent protection in the country. So even if they have work rights, and many of them don't, they can't really put down roots here in the country. They can't find a way to safety and belonging because they don't have permanent residency. And so that's a real challenge. And yeah, look, COVID absolutely exacerbated that and really grew the challenge for people who are already feeling unsupported and largely unwelcome in the country.
So how many staff does Many Coloured Sky have here in Melbourne?
We're a team of six, but we're not full-timers, so that's about the equivalent of four full-time positions. Really excitingly, we have two phenomenal people who are part of the queer refugee community themselves who lead a lot of the work. We have a couple of social work positions, and then we've got a couple of admin and leadership positions as well.
That is an extraordinary amount of work for six staff, you know, totaling four full-timers. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, look, it's pretty nuts. We could, if we had twice as many people, we would still be busy. We've got some fantastic volunteers who do really heavy lifting, and so many of those are from the queer refugee community itself, which is fantastic, but also more broadly in the queer community. We're so small that we can't support volunteers as well as I would like to. So yeah, otherwise I'd be saying, please come on down and volunteer your time with us. We're hoping to be in a position where we really can grow that work in the coming year, because we see the importance of that. But yeah, we're also really keen to ensure that we've got those substantive positions as an anchor to really support what is complicated work.
So how many volunteers have you got?
Good question. Look, I would say that there's probably 15 or so who are actively putting in work every single week. So helping with events, just helping coordinate things, picking up things for us, helping people get around, helping people navigate their way to kind of services and supports. And then we would probably have 20 more who put in around a specific issue. So they might come and run a workshop once a month or just in different ways get involved.
Ian Seal from Many Coloured Sky. People can go to manycolouredsky.org and check your organisation out. Thank you so much for joining us today on 3CR.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
3CR.